Ba, 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 ba.
Here we are again.
Ba, 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 ba. For once,
welcome
wait,
to
shut up.
Yelling at
for,
Cassius
shut up.
Anomaly.
Shut up,
oh,
shut
my
up.
Goodness.
For once, my wife's not asleep while I record this, so I can project from the diaphragm.
Okay. Well, again, welcome to Yelling at Cassius Anomalies, everyone. Again, your host, Matt Ross, with my co-host, or my XO, as he points out, I'm the captain, Michael Pontone. How are we doing tonight, Mike?
Michael Pontone, Commander, to my captain, Matt Ross. I'm doing pretty well.
Well, tonight we just saw the Corbomite Maneuver, considered one of the best Star Treks out of every series, but especially out of the original series. This is a interesting. Well, there we go. Me, you saying interesting again.
Mm-hmm.
This is a fun or fascinating adventure for Star Trek. One of the more adult stories, you could say.
Ironically,
what
yes.
We've just seen. Yes. This is actually interesting. Again, there I said it. This is the first episode filmed after the pilot, where no man has gone before. But it was actually the 10th episode that they broadcast, because NBC wanted to have something more simple than the concepts in this thing. But what did you think of this story overall,
Mike? Well, let me give the IMDb synopsis. Episode aired November 10th, 1966, so 58 years ago. After the Enterprise is forced to destroy a dangerous marker buoy, a gigantic alien ship arrives to capture and condemn the crew as trespassers. Well, I gotta say this. I do not understand the production, because if this was the first one filmed and it had a beautiful full cast of the Magnificent Seven, right? Sulu, Scotty.
True.
Uhura, Spock, McCoy, and Kirk, although, okay, yeah, not the Magnificent Seven, because Pavel is not in there yet. But still, it's strange that we have all them around the table doing their job, Scotty being Scotty, Sulu being Sulu, and then they disappear for the other episodes after this, because there are multiple episodes where there's no Sulu and no Scotty and no Uhura. So if there was a show Bible, were there established supporting characters?
Well, these characters, well, I can answer it as Mr. Krabs would say, money!
Money!
You know, it all costs money. By the way, Nichelle Nichols as Uhura, there's an interesting story about her, which I'll get to in a second, but she cost $1,000 for this one production. So they are expensive. At $1,000 in 1966 dollars, which available today is something like, $200 billion today. But it's
probably 10 grand, right?
Yeah, probably. But, you know, for a couple of days' work, 5-6 days of shooting, that can be quite expensive. So that's why they weren't all in there. The main stars, Shatner and Nimoy, they were all the money was going, just like on most productions today.
Yeah.
So that's why that you didn't see them all the time. In fact, this was supposed to be the introduction of McCoy, Uhura, and Scotty.
Hmm.
So it's a little weird because, as you've pointed out, they go in and out. You could say it's like a shift change on the bridge. But the way they are shown here... it's a nice introduction, and since you have seen pieces of this series and other Star Trek, you are familiar with them. But it was quite a shock, by the way, to have a black woman on the bridge at the time. That was wasn't Roddenberry's idea. In fact, it was the idea of the director, Joseph Sargent. Roddenberry just happened to know Nichelle Nichols. He recommended her. Also, she was in one of his other TV shows called The Lieutenant, and then later was discovered that he was having an affair with Nichelle Nichols. But at that time,
naturally, I could have called that one a million miles away.
You know, the great bird of the galaxy, Gene Roddenberry, he's the Lothario, not James T. Kirk. But, and we get to see Scotty as the engineer. What was interesting, it also on this, is that that director, Joseph Sargent, helped Nimoy come up with his character, because Nimoy was saying, I'm not getting what Spock is supposed to be. And Joe Sargent told him, act kind of scientific. You are the scientist, and you are unemotional, and you look at things scientifically, not emotionally, like your human compatriots. So when they see the objects, everyone's gasping, but Spock looks up and says, fascinating. And that's how the Spock character came about. What did you think of that entire little opening with him, like, almost sounding like from Where No Man Has Gone Before? Prepare to photograph.
Check the circuit.
And just kind of yelling orders. Is that something you'd expect Spock to do? Or,
I mean, I liked it. And I like that, again, there were already things getting established that you wouldn't see in much later Trek as regular fixtures, including non-captain sitting in the captain's chair. You know, just like a real ship. So I like seeing Spock there on the captain's chair, taking care of business. I liked this weird thing of the captain being vulnerable, shirt off, doing a physical. You know, shows that it's just, again, military crew in space, officers with officer personalities. I mean, it was very smart, probably not easy way to write, but at least a logical way to write for Roddenberry, where it's like, okay, if I was writing a, like you said, wagon train in space, or not even wagon train, if I was just writing an exploratory mission in space, what would it be like? You know, people's personalities would be the same. I'm rambling a little bit here. Let's get into it. What is up with Roddenberry and his love of large geometric shapes and association with them being evil? Because now we got the Borg cube, the crystalline entity, and what is it called again? Well, Fasarius?
The Fasarius. No, Fasarius. That wasn't him. You remember, those are the production designers that came up with that stuff. It was large spaceship.
Well, that's quite the quinky thing there.
Yes, it sure is. But that, you could say that later shows borrowed that. And by the way, everyone, there is in our community tab a poll of who would win, the Borg or the Fasarius in size. Because as we first, but before we even get there, we first have that weird marker buoy that's spinning around, that weird cube. It's one of the weirder things that you see in any science fiction, just a weird geometric shapes. When they were designing they said, what would be the weirdest thing? This is an actual portion that I get this, some of our information from These Are the Voyages, which is a TOS reference kind of book. Yes, it's also where I get my Greek history from. But These Are the Voyages mentions that the production designer said, what would be the weirdest thing to see in outer space? Well, weird geometric shapes. You can't get weirder than a cube just kind of spinning. So that's why they did that. It was very bizarre.
I liked it a lot.
I actually liked
it. You know, kind of disco. Yeah. Very well done. Yeah. Good effect. Again, we're watching the remastered one, so I don't know what it originally looked like. But
it's pretty close to it. It's actually really close to what the original one is.
Right.
But before that, you also see there's a banter between all the crew on every level and in every scene. Spock to Bailey, where Bailey's acting kind of nervous and unsure, and Spock cuts into him. I know, Bailey, you don't like.
Bailey's
a
weirdo,
not supposed to, you know? He's, like, new. But it starts off with Kirk in, as you were saying, in sick bay. And I thought it was bizarre. McCoy sees the red alert lights going off, and he doesn't interrupt his physical to tell the captain there's something wrong. A little bit negligent, in my opinion. Especially, you know, you're in deep space exploration. Tell the captain the red alert klaxon's going off, which is conspicuously absent from sickbay. But, of course, McCoy comments that if he responded to every light that went off, he'd be talking to himself, which he is in that scene. That's the comment.
You can see the alarm lights flashing from there, McCoy. Why didn't you tell me?
Might have finished a physical on you, didn't I? What am I, a doctor or a moon shuttle conductor?
I jumped every time a light came on around here. I'd end up talking to myself.
But you do have...
Genius.
Exactly. You do have the camaraderie among the crew. You can even see it, and you can even see its stresses fraying all the way through as the situation gets more tense. But we get the cube, and they try and move around it, but they can't. So they're forced to destroy it. But this is the point where you realize that Bailey is just not cut out for his job. Freezes.
Nope. Yes.
What were
despite
you
being the
that?
One speaking, well, yeah, despite being the one saying, let's blow it up the entire time. Yeah, he's not very Starfleet. Again, you wouldn't see any of this on a Galaxy-class ship. Everyone was keeping their cool as everyone's dying around them. Like, that's the thing I like about later Trek, you know, 80s, 90s Trek, where it's just like, all right, you know, there are bad humans out there, but these are the elites. These are the best of the best. I mean, they're astronauts, just like... You know, Apollo 13, if you ever listen to the audio of that, it's not cinematic. Like, half the ship blows out on their tin can, and they're like, oh, there's a problem. Like, it's a lot less dramatic than it is in the movie.
Well, this is a TV show, so they need the drama.
I know, by having one mad Irishman named Bailey. Good-looking guy. Looks a little bit like William Holden or Peter Graves.
He's 25 in this. That character's... this is actually his only appearance, by the way. The actor's name is, hold on, I have it written down. Yes, I still use paper.
Papier? Papra?
Papra, yes. His name was Anthony Call, but he was one of several people. He was going to be crewman number one. The actual person who was going to play Bailey at one point was that guy, Joe, who stabs himself with a dull butter knife. In the naked time?
We don't belong. I don't belong. Six people died down there.
But this guy won out. He was in Twilight Zones and various other TV shows doing, as I referred to it recently and others have called it, the Desilu run. You know, you would see him in bit parts here and there all over the place. But he is even commented that he has been promoted too fast because the captain sees something in him that reminds him of himself when maybe 11 years ago. It's only now, you don't know it yet, but Kirk is theoretically supposed to be about between 30 and 35, the youngest captain in Starfleet because he's like the whiz kid. But
sure.
Bailey is...
That tracks.
Yeah, but Bailey is just maybe promoted too quickly. Maybe he was... more professional and calm in whatever position he was before. And Kirk said, let's just give the kid a shot. And he just can't handle sitting at navigation, which isn't just reading maps. So that's pretty apparent. I do find that McCoy's digging into the captain about it. It's pretty harsh. You know, you promoted him too fast. And... another thing that's also noticed in other podcasts, specifically the Penske podcast, hi Wes, if you're listening, the catchphrase that they were trying to push on Dr. McCoy is, I never said that, as opposed to, he's dead, Jim. That hasn't happened really yet. Then they go down to, he decides to have, what they were trying to do at this point after they destroy the cube, is they run battle drills. And you hear... the chatter in the back. Did you feel like you were on inside a ship at that point as well? Did you still have your military feel?
Yeah, it was fine. I mean, I didn't feel like I was on the ship. I felt like I was on my couch watching.
So,
yes. What? I don't know. It's not that transportative.
Okay. It's okay.
Cardboard sets, man.
Well, to me,
it was good.
To me, I always feel like I'm on the ship. And then we get to see actually, technically for the first time, Yeoman Rand. And Kirk comments, if I get my hands on the headquarters genius that gave me a female yeoman, and McCoy
How
quips,
dare he?
What, you
He's
don't
trust?
Yeah, he goes, what's the matter, Captain? You don't trust yourself? He actually says, what's the matter, Jim? You don't trust yourself? He goes, I already have a lady to take care of. It's the Enterprise.
Darn tootin'.
Yeah.
Yep.
There's also a line here that's never really finished. The battle drills are finished, And Spot gives him a rating of 94%. Hmm. And they aim for 100%. And McCoy asks, what are you going to do with that extra 6%? He goes, I'm going to take it. And I'm going to, the rest of the line is supposed to be, make them stick to it. But I like that little back and forth between Kirk and McCoy, is that banter. You know, in real life, this is, they haven't had many scenes together. Technically, they've only had this. That there's a certain camaraderie and, I guess, electricity between them as actors. What would you call that?
Chemistry.
Chemistry, that's the word. Yeah. You know,
yes, and folks playing off each other.
Yep, they seem to fit. Then they get called to the bridge. Red alert, not something you want to do when you're interrupted for your dinner. And then something way larger is coming toward the Enterprise. And that's when we get to see the Fasarius.
Fasarius sphere.
What did you think of the Fasarius, which is bigger than a Borg cube?
Wait, are you sure about that? Because they said it was a mile wide.
It looks cool. Well, it's a circle.
I know, but they said a mile wide. A Borg cube is bigger than a mile.
Is it?
One
of our fans, Kara, will tell us all about it, or anyone else who wants to listen in and give us the measurements. 34, 24, 36, or something like that. I think the Fasarius is pretty huge as well. What did you think, though, of the effect of the Fasarius? You are seeing the remastered version, but what did you think of it?
I dug it. It was great design. You know, again, watching that as a kid in 1966, it must have blown your mind. It was beautiful. And again, strange synchronicity with the fact that they just love their geometric shapes. I mean, there were a lot of Borg things in here, right? I mean, it's huge. It's geometric. It rolls up on them. A being of advanced intelligence just speaks in this staccato declaratory sentences about what's going to happen. It was one step away from resistance is futile. That's the thing. With Borg, Borg did not get introduced while Gene Roddenberry was alive. Do you think that they were working off any notes or anything?
No, it's a different concept. Actually, the Borg were sort of created when Roddenberry was alive. There was, but they weren't supposed to be what they are—the cybernetic organisms that we see them in Next Gen. They were actually supposed to be bugs. What were they supposed to be? They were supposed to be bugs. Oh. In fact,
that makes sense.
Well, the conspiracy episode in the first season of TNG is that those are technically the Borgs, kind of, but the effects were pretty piss poor even if you compare it to a lot of the original series special effects. But that's the idea.
Oh, yeah, no, we've always stated the first season of TNG is more dated than TOS.
That's quite true. But by the way, that voice of Commander Baylock, that is actually our friend Mr. Cassidy, who is also Ruck from What Are Little Girls Made Of? You know, Lurch.
No further communication will be accepted. If there is the slightest hostile move, your vessel will be destroyed immediately.
So you could put in your own headcanon that maybe the old ones made the Fasarius for who Baylock later turns out to be. But at this point, there's panic setting on the bridge and the rest of the ship. And you can see their calm demeanor is breaking down. Bailey has a total freak out on the bridge.
Go to the brig, Bailey.
Yeah, it's like, you're relieved. What are you doing? Counting down? What are you all, robots, he says? It's,
Oh, yeah, by the way, that 10 minutes goes on for a very long time.
Well, it is
enough time
minutes
for him to get down to sick bay and get medically evaluated by McCoy.
Well, I think he just gave him, like, a shot of whiskey because, you know, McCoy is an alcoholic.
Well, but Bailey. Yes.
Sorry, give me the brandy! But, scene where they just remove him from the bridge is kind of shocking. You know, you would expect, as you were pointing out, these are supposed to be professionals. But again, no crying. Kirk is...
Yes,
I know.
We don't have to punch down on that idiot series. It's getting canceled. It's getting put out of its misery.
Thank God. Put out all of our miseries. But I do like that, you know, he can't even find a solution from Spock. You know, he's saying, Spock, what do you think? Well,
chess. What is that, Munched? The game is over. Checkmate. Is that your best recommendation? I regret that I can find no other logical alternative.
Yeah. You're dead. Go ahead.
That was a scary one. I was very genuinely curious when he did not have an answer. I'm like, man, how are they going to get out of this one? By the way, quick. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are many. So, yes, once again, we've got Echoes of Future Trek, big, scary, geometric ship. And the like buoy that was kind of following them around. What was the episode from TNG when they are stuck and like the more they try to leave, the harder it gets. So they have to just coast out on thrusters.
Are you talking about Booby Trap where they meet they see the Promethean battle cruiser? God, how I know this stuff.
And it's Leia Brahms in that episode, right? Leia Brahms?
Yeah, the creepy Geordi episode. Well, actually, there are.
Oh, whatever. Ain't that creepy.
Yeah, oh, okay. God.
You know, in the 24th century, that's the equivalent of looking at a Playboy, having sex with the image of someone that you have a crush on in the holodeck. Everyone's doing it.
That's the OnlyFans of its day. That really dates this podcast, I'm sure, already.
We're going to get demonetized, our precious 3 cents, Matt.
We have to get monetized first. So keep liking, sharing, and subscribing.
And then we'll
everyone.
Get demonetized. Help us get demonetized, everyone.
Yes. Give them money, then take it away.
Yes. I've got more.
Go ahead.
Oh, come on. I just had it in my noggin.
Well,
it went away.
Well, how about we talk about Baylock himself and the creature effect for that? What did you think of that?
I loved it. I wish that they had stuck with it. When I first saw it, I was like, oh, man, great. An actual alien, no forehead ridges. Of course, it gets ruined at the end, but I guess that's okay.
Well, I mean, it does and it doesn't, but Baylock is pretty scary. They use that dummy. There's a funny promo picture of him with a cigarette in his mouth. but it was created by a Star Trek effects specialist named Hua Chang. He actually made a lot of the props and so forth in this show, and he worked all the way through the 70s and some into the 80s. Uncredited. He makes a lot of things. We'll see it more and more as we come along.
So is a Chinese set designer or a prop master?
Aloha, he's a Hawaiian. Good designs all the way through, and you can read all about him on the Wikipedia. That Baylock is freaky. In fact, that face is like adorns almost everything. I even have a picture of my wife and son at the 50th anniversary of Star Trek standing next to Baylock.
The original puppet?
It's a recreation.
Yeah, they probably
there's not too
the
many
original.
Originals of anything.
Right.
Yeah, they destroyed most of these sets afterwards. It's very sad. Next gen, they had most of the sets. They had a big Christie's auction. I have that catalog. Costs money, too.
Mm-hmm.
But that was pretty interesting, where everything they try and do, they can't get away. They're stuck. Baylock says, we're going to destroy you, and starts giving them a 10-minute countdown. You have 10 time units known as minutes.
Yes.
And they start counting down.
Now, another...
Freaky.
That's what I was thinking about. Another Echoes of Future Trek, which I kind of dig. The maneuver. The first maneuver. So let's go through all the maneuvers, okay? So
the Riker maneuver?
I like the Riker maneuver. That's not the one where he's... Okay, yeah, so we got joke maneuvers and actual maneuvers, okay? So let's go through this. So the actual maneuver, I guess, for him, Kirk, would be the carbonite maneuver, which is just a poker bluff. And I guess the joke one would be the classic move that he does in his fights when he goes down on his back and uses his leg to vault the guy over him. You know what I'm talking
okay.
about?
Yes.
Now we got the Picard maneuver, of course, which is, of course... made in the Stargazer.
Pulling down your shirt.
I was talking about the real one with the Stargazer, where he goes to light speed in the same star system to trick another ship into thinking there are two of them and the sensors. He defeated Ferengi that way. And of course, yes, pulling down his shirt. And we got the Riker maneuver. We got two of those. I'm going to give these to you. Go ahead.
You mean stepping over chairs?
It's not a question. You just said it. Declare it. You're the captain. Yes.
I have to say, he's stepping over chairs, yes. Moving slowly to the left when they're being attacked by the Borg. Is that the one you're talking about?
No, they even say it in one of the more dubious TNG movies. We should call that the Riker maneuver.
I don't remember which one that is.
It's okay. I know. It's okay.
I feel sad.
Well, you're more of a TOS guy. So
Now, I know TNG pretty well, too. I just can't remember the one called the Riker Maneuver. Is that crashing the Enterprise on a ship?
That's the,
on the planet?
That's the Deanna Troi Maneuver. That's no, incorrect. False, as Rich Evans would say. The Riker Maneuver is in Star Trek Insurrection, when he's fleeing the Sona ships in the Briar Patch, the nebula full of different clouds and gases that are volatile.
Oh, you mean the Star Trek II Wrath of Khan homage maneuver? Yes, that one.
Oh, wait. What? Yeah. Right. Yeah. So he uses the warp nacelles. I guess they've got some troughs. He captures the gas and he kind of does a swooping maneuver in front of the Sona ships and puts a screen of gas between them, and then they fire.
Right.
And arguably, you know, from Picard season 3, there was a third Riker maneuver that was pretty impressive.
Mm-hmm.
Can you think of it?
Now go ahead, tell me which one it is.
When he hurls the asteroid at the Shrike.
Oh, you mean from the third season of Picard, yes. Season 3, The Apology. Yes, I recall.
Season 3, that, The Redemption. I love that season.
The Apology. It's best of 5 out of 10, if you're lucky.
I would rate I would give it... Okay, look, I'm going to call a spade. You're right. I want to say 8 out of 10. It is a 7 out of 10. But it is pretty good. Terry Metalis, very talented guy. I'm like, Terry, you be consistent, right? If the Shrike is full of changelings, why are they sometimes changelings and sometimes not? Because they certainly don't act. They act like solids when it's convenient to the plot. They act like changelings when it's convenient to the plot. But they certainly aren't acting like either one.
Well, that's because they don't really know how to write Star Trek. That's the real reason. Listen, but that's another story. That's a story for another time.
Good season, tight plot. I'm so thankful that it exists. That's all I'm going to say. Let's move on.
Well, you know, if you're going to compare it to anything that's out of the newer stuff, yes, that's some of the, if not the best, and that is, to quote a Morton Joe, mediocre.
Mediocre.
But, right. So it's okay. But getting back to this episode, I think this has a little bit more to it. It grabs you from the beginning and takes you all the way through. And here we are, McCoy, like a jackass, comes up to the bridge when they've got like 4 minutes left to live. And he decides to pick a fight with Kirk. And we come up to that line, "Anytime you can bluff me, Doctor." And that's when the idea hits.
Not chess, Mr. Spock. Poker.
Bluff.
But you were saying that what a bureaucratic ass McCoy is at that time. At least that's my impression of what you were saying. But what do you think of McCoy coming up there acting like that?
That was very confusing. I'm not going to lie. I was a little, I found that to be a little odd. But yeah, whatever. Again, they're still getting the old storytelling boots on the ground, their sea legs. It's okay.
That's true. That's true. Well, you know, but that's what gives Kirk the idea to play poker. And he says to Spock, "Not chess." And then we have our classic lines there. And he comes up with an idea out of his butt. He decides to pull Horbomite, saying that you've scanned us, but you don't know have all our history. We have a device that if you shoot us, it shoots you right back and blow you up. And that freaks out the Fasarius. And then you see there's a change where the big ship runs away and a little tiny ship takes control of the Enterprise and takes them to be destroyed somewhere else. But that little bluff played by Kirk and Shatner, I think, is very well handled and very clear. Clearly showing that he is pulling something out of his hat. What did you think of the way that was conveyed on the screen?
It was good. It was quite the long shot. I'm glad that it didn't necessarily immediately work. And I mean, also, it's bad. It would kind of be bad writing, except for the fact that, because like, why would this advanced alien fall for that? But the fact that on the other end, it was essentially a benevolent kid. I was like, okay, well, I guess that kind of explains its own bad writing. You know what
but
I mean?
He's not a kid. So
no, but he's not an evil. He didn't actually have any murderous intent, right?
No, that's true. But this starts the grand set of stories where I was like, well, we were just some superior aliens just testing you the entire time. It's a continued theme in Star Trek. But there are some bluffs. Kirk actually, throughout his career and throughout Trek, has bluffs all the time. He uses this Corbomite maneuver in many different ways. I think my favorite line, though, on that little speech is, life has little meaning to us, so attack us now. We grow tired of your foolishness. That's actually one of my favorite lines from this episode. It's just like, yep. What else you got to lose, you know? It's just like, banging your shoe on the table when you have nothing else. And
yeah, what's another good bluff that Kirk does? I mean, when he slows down, you know, when he stalls Khan while he puts down
exactly.
the...
Because hours would seem like days. That was Spock saying that to Kirk. Because he doesn't like to lose, but he would learn it from his earlier career, which is here. The thing that there's also, by the way, one little weird error. You'll see George Takei say, "I knew he would." That's taken out of weird context. There was supposed to be an extra line there, which is Baylock was going to say at this point, "We grant you one more minute." And then Sulu says, "I knew he would." That's what it was actually supposed to be there. And yet they've never taken that out of any version. It just doesn't make sense, but it is what it is.
How do you know all this?
Well, apparently I like Star Trek. No, I've been following Star Trek since I've been 4 years old, back in the Stone Age. So these are little things you know. Like, you know that Rand's hair chessboard is two wigs pushed together. That's kind of bizarre. The original Fisarius was ping pong balls, and they were lighting it up. That was part of the reason it was taking so long, the special effects, and they were running out of time. So that's also one of the other reasons why it wasn't first in the broadcast order. It was, again, second in production, but 10th in showing. I think so far, out of everything we've seen so far, it's the stronger story. Then they get...
I would disagree.
Oh, okay.
I liked the Enemy Within more.
Okay.
I liked the Mantrap more. I think that the producers did a pretty good job.
Mm-hmm.
I dug Mantrap. I mean... Past that, I don't know.
I like
Where No Man Has Gone Before.
Okay.
It was okay.
Well, the one Where No Man Has Gone Before was just the concept pilot. So this is what the actual first series was started with. And if the series had started with this, I think it would have had maybe a stronger showing. If they could continue going up from this, I think it would have been stronger all the way through. But this is considered one of the higher points of the series. I actually enjoy this one immensely. I only have a couple other things to mention on this. When we get there, when they finally escape from the Fisarius in the small ship, they board the ship to find the puppet, which is actually Baylock. And they also discover, as you pointed out, Clint Howard, the brother of Ron Howard, wearing a bald cap. Yes, they did talk to him about shaving his head, but his dad said no. He's supposed to be an incredibly long-lived alien, very old, like 400 years old, running this big ship. It's you know, you're meeting a new alien race. I don't know. What did you, were you disappointed in the ending? Because I get
yes,
that impression.
I was quite disappointed. Well, I mean, he's just like, oh man, of everything you could think up, like, it was just a kid looking alien. He knows that he doesn't look intimidating, so, and he knows that Earthlings think that this thing would be scarier looking. He could have just, I suppose. Okay, so when have we seen aliens do this in TNG?
He was testing.
We've seen this in The Nth Degree, right? When they make Barclay very smart. A little bit in that really xenophobic race in Clues. That's like, hey, we have to erase your memory, or we have to kill you. You can choose. And a little bit 1% of the Changelings, because they were certainly kicking our tires before they decided to try to kill us. They were like, you know, let's see if you're good enough to not pose us a threat. Oh, you would pose us a threat. We have to kill you.
Well, but you know, but it all started from somewhere. I wouldn't go with Clues for that one. But I mean, this is, you know, you've got an alien race. They're testing humanity to see what they are talking about. What are their high-minded ideals? You've got this advanced race exploring all over the place. The only thing that I find disappointing is that you never see the Fisarius again, but there are references to pieces of it. The drink they serve, or what Baylock serves, Tranya, is actually chilled pink grapefruit juice, which Howard said he couldn't stand. But they actually serve it in Quark's bar in DS9. They serve Tranya. Someone asked for, can I have a Tranya? Sure, here you go. So whatever the First Federation is or was, is part of the regular Federation. And whatever technology they had, you would presume they gave it to the Federation to use somewhere. Maybe that's why.
I guess
the D is
there must
better.
Be some sort of program. Yes.
Yeah.
And I guess that Bailey was a little too happy, like, to get off the ship where presumably all of his friends and possessions and belongings are, in order to go live on this gigantic sphere with this very creepy looking alien. I mean, honestly, I'm not gonna lie. If I get to choose between, if I had to spend like 6 months on an exchange mission with an alien that looked like the kid or the alien that looked like the giant scary one, I think I'd take the giant scary one.
Well, there is
too creepy.
There is a continuation of the Bailey story in a Star Trek novel.
Oh, really?
Yeah, sort of. It's in a book by Christopher Bennett called The Face of the Unknown. I did start reading it, but I kind of lost interest in a lot of Star Trek novels. I don't know.
I've never really picked one up. My brother's really into them.
Some of them are good.
I've read a little bit of it. Like, apparently, like, there's a big Borg war and Risa gets destroyed, right?
I believe so, but I haven't read that one. I think that's in the Shatner stories. I actually like
this. Of course, you would want to go to Risa.
The James Blish adaptations of the original series are pretty good. It fills in things here and there. Just like Alan Dean Foster, he filled in things also on the original series and the animated series in the movies. Alan Dean Foster, you might know him writing from the screenplay, I believe, for Aliens. He's in lots of other things, too. But James Blish was the man to write these things. And I recommend everyone, if they'd like to get a little bit more detail, to get the James Blish novelizations of the Star Trek original series. They're actually quite good. And Alan Dean Foster's logs. Yeah, they are. You know, if you once you see the series, you're like, oh, I know that. But they're little like lines and extra pieces that it just fills in your head canon, so you know what the heck's going on a little bit more.
Well, apparently the novelization of Star Trek V Final Frontier was much better than the movie.
Yes, it was.
So
I
gotta pick that one up sometime.
I mean, if you want, I could give you the big spoiler that drives me crazy in it, but why don't we see?
No, don't.
I'll save it for the Star Trek V review, but I read that one. Something also...
Quick aside.
Yes.
Tranya cocktail recipe, according to the internet. 1 ounce coconut rum. Mm-hmm. Oh, of course, it just disappears. 1 ounce coconut rum, 1 ounce peach tree schnapps, 0.25 ounces amaretto, 2 ounces cranberry juice, and 2 ounces pineapple juice. Gross. Don't drink it.
I don't
stick to your Romulan ale.
All right. Well, you know, I think I'd probably rather just have like, some of that Dickel's Tennessee whiskey, which is in the Saurian brandy bottle. That's what that is, the 1967 bottle. I'll try any of that. I have the Star Trek cocktail book. Maybe we'll have a special version on camera where we mix cocktails and try them out.
I got a great idea. Mm-hmm. You know Drunk History?
Yes.
We do Drunk Star Trek History.
What do you guys think, Yelling at Gaseous Anomalies fans? Should we do a drunk cocktail?
One of us, yes.
Yeah, why not do it?
One of us gets completely drunk.
Why
and
one?
We'll put like 10. Well, because the other one has to film.
No, we don't. That's what this modern age is. We just put cameras down. We'll be fine. It'll be fine.
I'd love to try to explain the Kittimer Accords while I'm blackout drunk on Romulan.
That's not so hard.
I guess that's true. All right.
No kill eye, but that's a story for a later bit. I will get one other thing. This was shot under budget. This was $190,430. It came under budget by like about a couple hundred bucks. This is $1.35 million in 2013 dollars, by the way, which is from that book.
Expensive.
Something else that's interesting that I learned is that George Takei commented about how everyone on the set got along and it felt like a big family. I guess that didn't last too long since, Shatner and...
Does not like Kirk.
Yeah, they act like they hate each other. Maybe they do. It's kind of disappointing when you see your heroes... hate each other in real life type of thing. I still find it enjoyable. I don't know what else there is to add on this. Is, you know, the Viserys is gone. You have that little ship. And it was a test the entire time to get their grapefruit juice. And Kirk even comments he's going to get a better officer. Why don't you just insult him to his face more? I still like the episode, so I don't think there's anything else we have to add to it. To me, it's a romping good time, going through space, meeting aliens, and seeing big giant shapes. So, what would you give it on our scientific 1 to 10 scale?
Compared to what we've seen so far, 7 out of 10.
Wow.
Compared to Trek in general, as a whole, all my knowledge of Trek. 6 out of 10.
Wow. Well, I'm going to have to respectfully disagree, sir. I'm actually going to give this a 9 out of 10.
I'll kill you if you say anything different.
9 out of 10. You have 10 seconds to comply. Or I'll give you 10 of my Earth minutes for you to change your mind. I think the interaction of the crew is good. I think the story drags you right on in. There's a bit of terror in it. Yes, it does drag when they're pulling away. But I think overall the lighting, the music is incredible. There are some little weird interludes like Yeoman Rand making coffee. But the general idea of meeting something unknown, watching the crew kind of unravel their mostly calm or their professional demeanor, not to the point of tears, but to the point of panic, is something that you would kind of expect to see meeting an insurmountable enemy. Luckily, it turned out peaceful, and we move along our way. So I find that makes that story enjoyable. The tension that's built up from the cube to the Viserys itself appearing is quite high. And for me, it's an enjoyable romp. That's my total opinion on this thing. So there. What do you think? Now that I've told you that.
Again, didn't thrill me. Not bad. Just didn't blow my mind. I've liked other things more so far in this series. But listen, it's good. And when I make my own iconic decade-spanning sci-fi series, then I can really have an opinion that should be paid attention to. But in the meantime, you guys are all fine.
Well, yeah, I hope I can play crewman number 4 at least. Yeah, one other thing about this, it has a more modern story into it. John Stewart actually made a trick saying that you're with water to try and show fear in society. He says, these water bottles have corbomite within it. And it caused a mini panic. He was trying to make a point. He says, you're afraid of something that's not even real. It's a true story. So Corbin White still lives on today. But I think that really does wrap it up. Anything else you want to tell our fans besides to now don't forget to vote in our community polls and to also like, share, and subscribe? Anything else you want to add to our happy little cruise here?
Nope. I dig you guys. Maybe we should have one of them on, do a quick 5-minute interview, see what they think. I'm loving it. I'm enjoying this great journey with you, Matt. Thank you very much, Captain.
Well, it's always a pleasure to have you around, XO. Coming up next, we have a two-parter which reuses the cage. It's called The Menagerie, Parts 1 and Part 2. I haven't decided if we're going to do it all at once because our time is limited due to our exciting job schedule. I enjoy having time talking this over with you and talking to everyone out there. Again, remember, if you want to contact us, please feel free to email us at yellingatgas@gmail.com or look for us on our Facebook page. And don't forget to give us a nice rating on Apple Podcasts with a 5-star rating, if you don't mind, and everywhere else, and tell everyone about us. So we hope to see you next time on Yelling at Gaseous Anomalies. Live long and prosper, Mike.
And you, sir.
All right. See you next time, everyone.